always a pleasure to be at PI. And I should also say happy birthday to General Relativity. And I can't think of a better way to celebrate. Okay. I think it was yesterday, so I'm a little bit, yeah. GR will forgive us if you know we're a little bit late. Okay. Good. So, and yeah, I wanted to talk about these two works with these Santa Barbarians, Steve Giddings, Don Maroff, and Eric Minton, who's a senior graduate student. I think he's graduating this year. Anyway, okay, good. So then they're both on the topic. You know, they're sort of different. Different sort of regimes, but they're both on the same sort of topic on locality and gravity. Okay, so we expect quantum gravity to be built on two pillars, roughly. Okay, one of them is quantum field theory. Okay, and quantum field theory is a theory of local operators, phi of x. Are labeled by, you know, labeled by space-time points, and they, what we mean by locality, is usually stated by this axiom, that if we take the commutator of two of these objects at space-like separation, then this thing is zero. Okay, good. Okay, the other pillar we will probably want to base our theory of quantum gravity on is general relativity. And general relativity is a diffeomorphism invariant theory. This is a gauge symmetry of the theory. And so all of our operators had better be invariant under this symmetry. Now, if you want to construct such things, which here I'll call capital phi, okay, it's generically these things must be in non-local. So a generic type of thing that you can write down is, say, you know, some integral over all of space-time, which I'm taking four-dimensional for the moment, you know, root g of O of x, some local scalar operator. So this is about as far removed from this type of locality as you can be. And so there's sort of a, you know, there's a sort of tension right at the heart of you know, trying to combine general relativity and quantum field theory. I should mention, please feel free to interrupt, you know, make things interactive. I'd be happy if this just devolves into a discussion. But anyway, okay, good. And okay, so this raises a question: is what should replace these sort of algebras of local operators in a theory of gravity? You know, that's sort of the big question. How can you think about, say, local subsystems in a theory of gravity? And moreover, we know this to be an excellent, while it looks like there's a huge incompatibility here, we know that in practice this is an excellent approximation. And so we should be able to find we know that this principle can't be an exact sort of axiomatic principle in the way that it's usually taken, we expect it to be a very good approximation, and we just want to look at what do we expect for the corrections to this approximation. So that's basically the question. All right. Good. So the plan is basically this. So first, I'm going to consider 3 + 1, so linearized gravity, and I'm going to couple it to a scalar field. So that's going to be my model. I'm going to work perturbatively about flat space. So this is part one. I want to define operators phi of x that are going to go to these phis in the limit where gravity is weak, and that are invariant. Okay. Under linearized diffeomorphisms. And then I want to look at the quantity phi of x. Phi of x prime. Okay. That's the first thing. And then in the second part, so the first part is this work with Steve. The second part with Don and Eric is to look at 2 plus 1 ADS gravity. And there we can actually say something about such about these operators and sort of bound their locality properties without recourse to perturbation theory. Okay, good. So first, I want to talk about how we're gonna construct invariant operators. So it's useful to have a simple example that's better known, and that for that for us that's going to be QED. So the problem of constructing gauge invariant operators in QED is actually very similar to this gravity case, and was considered long ago by Dirac. So as with many things in this business, you look it up and you find that Dirac got there first. Good. So in QED, suppose you have an electromagnetic field coupled to a scalar. So phi of x is not a gauge invariant object on its own. It has this familiar transformation law. Okay. Let's put it like that. And But we also have a gauge field in the game, which transforms like this, the usual way. Okay. Good. And then using these two objects, we can construct gauge invariants. So here's an example. So we can take a phi of x, you know, which is phi of x times this sort of dressing factor, ds, and then az x plus s. Yeah. So all you do is you take your operator, your scalar operator, and you take an electric, so there's, it's at some point x, and you take some line and say you run it out to, here I'm running it out to z equals infinity, I'm back in Canada. Good. And that defines a gauge invariant operator. And now you can ask, how should we think of this as a physical object in the theory? And the way that Dirac answered that question is you looked at the commutator of the electric field, say at some point x prime, with this phi of x. Okay, and then you find that it has some, it just takes the form of a single electric field line. So it's a delta function in the perpendicular direction, and then it's a theta function in the other direction. Did I get this? Yeah, sorry, like this. And then this is some prime. Okay. Good. Okay, so we can, so you can think of this as a scalar field together with a Wilson line going out to the boundary. Dirac, of course, didn't call it a Wilson line, he called it a Faraday line. I looked it up. Wilson at the time was a teenage undergrad at Harvard. So hadn't been thinking about Wilson lines just yet. Okay, good. So this sort of illustrates there's a kind of They're kind of two functions of the dressing. On one hand, you're building an invariant operator, and on the other hand, it's just the requirement that you create a state that satisfies the constraints. So you have, so if you create a charge, you have to have some electric flux. Okay. Yes, thank you. Yeah, right. So it's just saying that the field line is here, it's not over here. Yeah. And it's singular and supported on this line. So X perp are the, you know, X are the directions I've suppressed. Okay. Good. But now this is a very singular object. We know that if we act on the vacuum with this object, then what happens is this line, this thing rapidly decays, and we'd like to have a sort of more, we don't expect in nature to find many objects like this, so we'd like to have a sort of more a more physical thing, and Dirac also came up with the following operator, which is closer to what we're looking for. So here we have a Wilson. This is more like a Coulomb field where you have 5x. And now you dress it like this, where instead of putting this sort of single line integral, you put an integral over all of space with the Coulomb field. Okay. And then one can check that the commutator here simply generates the Coulomb field. So this corresponds now to, you know, an operator together with charged excitation together with its Coulomb field. Okay. Good. So the goal is to construct gravitational analogs of basically these two objects. Okay, so you can. So I'm going to start by constructing something that looks like this Wilson line, and then show how we can sort of use that to construct something that's more like a Coulomb field. And then ultimately, you know, so this is just sort of the setup of constructing the operators, and then I'm going to look at their commutators. So are there any questions about QED before we? What is it? Oh, you mean make this integral have support on some surface which is of some other codimension, you know, some other dimension. I don't see why not. Sure. Yeah. I expect those would also. I mean, those would also decay presumably. And yeah. So yeah. Any such thing is sort of not the lowest energy configuration. It's going to decay to something like this.
Yeah. Can you go to higher? I mean, this is picking a time slice. Calling on a time slice. If I was some other observer, that seems kind of obscure to me.
Yeah. Okay. That's a good question. Certainly you can. Yeah. But the thing is, this is all sort of on shell. So you have an equation of motion. So whatever you do, you can always bring it back to one slice. And so to think about what happens on one slice, it's more convenient to do this. But yeah, indeed, you can think of other things. So actually, an interesting one that we discussed in the paper, I wasn't prepared to talk about it, but I'll at least mention it because you bring it up, is to consider a particular world line. So now this is time, you know, and this is space. And now you can consider a world line, and you can look at an integral along there. And that also, I mean, you can tell just sort of by the symmetry of it, it actually creates something very much like this. What makes this a little bit more complicated is that this goes off to spatial infinity, basically, and your gauge transformations decay there. This one goes to the past, and you don't generally restrict your gauge transformations in the past. So this on its own doesn't define a gauge invariant operator. What you have to do is you have to take it back to some earlier time and then dress sort of that earlier point as well. So if this is my sort of Dirac picture. So you have some early you know, some early slice, say T equals T naught. You start with this sort of Dirac field. You start with your Coulomb thing, then you shoot a Wilson line in the time-like direction. Okay. This has some advantages. Unfortunately, I'm not going to say much about it. But maybe I'll come back to it when we get to gravity, because we did actually construct a gravitational analog of this guy. Okay. Great. Okay, so that's QED. So now gravity. Okay. So I'm looking at linearized gravity in flat space. So I'm going to expand my metric. Like this. Okay, kappa is square root of g, roughly. And now the gauge symmetries that I'm considering are diffeomorphisms. So my scalar field is going to go, it's going to transform like this. And my linearized metric, by the Lie derivative. As usual, yes.
I think this parameter is of a two-dimensional.
Good. So this is the standard normalization of H for when you're doing for when you're quantizing fluctuations of the metric. It's the canonical normalization. Good. Now on the topic of units, there's also right. So I've also absorbed kappa into this C diffeomorphism. So this might be a slightly unusual form, the fact that there's a kappa here and not here. And the reason I do that is basically just to make it more analogous to the case of QED. So you can see very clearly where the coupling is coming in. So I've defined it so that the field transformation law carries a power of the coupling, the scalar field transformation law carries the has the coupling in it, but the metric or gauge field doesn't.
Dimensionally, so if H goes as 1 to 1 over kappa in units, G is dimensionless, right?
Yeah.
So I'm just asking if psi has units of kappa, then doesn't really transform correctly, right? If mu has dimensionality.
I guess
so kappa over x or something like that. It's just psi doesn't have the same units as h.
Hold on.
Vector c or whatever it is dimensionless. Kappa absorbs the 1 over length from the derivative. So that's actually the first term.
Good. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Okay. And yeah. So we just want to find invariant combinations of under these transformations. Okay. So we can construct something that's like a Wilson line. The insight is that basically we want to do something invariant. We want to specify some operational procedure that doesn't depend on our choice of coordinates to define an operator phi of x. So what we're going to do, similar to the Wilson line, is we're going to give ourselves some platform at infinity. So this is going to be some, you know. So I'm not going to put it strictly at infinity. I'm going to make z equal big Z far away. Okay, and I'm going to pick some point on here with coordinate. Now, I'm going to assume that I have some set of coordinates on my platform, which is out at infinity. I'm going to pick a normal direction. I'm going to shoot a geodesic inward for some distance, which I'll call well, some distance, which is z minus little z, big z minus little z, so that it, you know, if this were flat space, it would hit the point x, x, y, z, and then I'm going to measure phi there. Okay. So that's my operational procedure, and I can write down an operator that realizes that basically by solving the linearized geodesic equation for this trajectory. So it's going to be x plus s z hat. So to zeroth order, it's just this straight line here, and then I write some correction, v mu of s. Okay. And then the demanding that be a geodesic allows me to solve for the this point here, which is going to be basically x mu plus v mu. Okay. So and the solution looks like this. You just, it's a second order differential equation whose source is the Christoffel symbols, so it's just an integral of the Christoffel symbols. So s times gamma z, z mu, and x plus s z hat. Okay. Plus a surface term that I'm not going to care about. Okay. And then the operator that I define, phi dressed by a Wilson line at x, is I now have to localize it. I have to evaluate, sorry, this is little phi. So I evaluate little phi, but I evaluate it at a coordinate that's specified in some invariant way, like this. So at linearized order, it's just x plus v w. And since we're, so since we're in the linearized theory, so these there's a factor of kappa in here. So this V is order kappa, and I'm going to expand this. Like so. Okay. So this is the general form of the operators I'm going to be considering. And if you look at what this creates, so now you can sort of characterize the field that this creates by looking at commutators of the metric operator with this gauge invariant thing. So you can look at things like h mu nu at x prime phi Wilson line of x. And what you find is that it starts out, you know, so that initially you have some very concentrated curvature that sort of expands outward and creates this very sort of singular solution, as you might expect, because if you sort of concentrate all of these, you're sort of concentrating your gravitational field lines, and that's not a stable configuration, just as in QED. Okay.
You also have to do it for h mu, right?
Pardon?
H mu is no longer a gauge
invariant. Yes, that's no, that's right. Good. So at this level, basically, what you're going to, so you, when you do this, you're going to find some h mu nu, and indeed, that's not an invariant object. So if you wanted to ask a gauge invariant question, you'd have to, you know, make some gauge invariant operator and put it here. That's right. But if you're looking at, if you just want to look at the solution, this is going to give me the solution in some gauge. Right. So whatever, so pick your favorite gauge invariant observable expressed in terms of h, right? I can now evaluate it on this state knowing this commutator. So this is the sort of first ingredient in asking those invariant questions. So indeed, this is going to give me something like the dressed field of this operator. It's going to give it to me in some gauge, which depends on, in fact, depends on the detail. So I haven't said a lot about the formalism that I'm using, but basically, you can, you know, there are lots of ways of defining this thing. There are different gauge fixings you can choose, and so on. They'll give you different h mu nus, but they're all just h mu nus in different gauges. So it's going to give me an answer to this question in some specific gauge, and then I have to extract, okay, what space-time is that actually? But I'm glad that you raised the point, because that's actually going to be important in the, when I consider a more explicit example next, which is the Coulomb field. Some kind of what?
Holonomy instead of
holonomy.
In the QED case, you get pi times some holonomy, right?
Yeah, right. This has to be an exponential. It's an exponential. It's not just some linear correction like it is here.
If you randomize in QED, you get exactly the same formula,
Exactly. You just expand the exponential to linear order, and you'd get a formula just like this. Yeah.
So why you don't do nonlinear gravity per se? I mean, what's what other
structures? Because it's not as simple as this simple exponential multiplying the field. So the reason that that is an exponential is because that's the form that the gauge transformations take. They take the form of just some exponent, you know, some phase multiplying the field at some point. And so that's some local thing that you construct. Here in GR, what you have to do is really exponentiate this transformation. So if you wanted to do the nonlinear thing in gravity, what you would be doing is specifying some object, say capital X, which is like your diffeomorphism that you're going to do. It's your sort of physical system of coordinates. And then you could evaluate phi at that sort of capital X. That's the analog of this thing, which is a finite gauge transformation. And then you'd have to solve some equation to determine this x, whose solutions would now be in terms of, some equation that you solve, and they wouldn't have these sort of simple integral-like forms, But yeah, so that's I think how the nonlinear extension works. Although here I'll be sticking to linear. At least for the first part. For the second part, I'll start to talk about some nonlinear questions, but not from this from a slightly different point of view. So good. Let me try to get there. Yeah.
B, we're formally thinking of it as small. It's small because it's oppressed by a quote unquote kappa.
That's right.
On the other hand, it can have arbitrarily long distances in it. Do I have to worry about that? If I'm very, very, I'm formally an infinite distance.
Good. Yes, I think. I think that you should worry about that. And indeed, that's what happens here. So if you look at this V mu, it's this very, so you have this integral from 0 to infinity that, with this s in it, so ds. So you're creating something that's very singular, even more so than in QED. Yeah, so if you're in, even in the QED case, you take, if you're in some non-trivial background and you look at the value of this line, yeah, it's huge. And so if you wanted to linearize, you're taking some exponential that winds around the circle many times and you're linearizing it, which is sort of nonsense. The fact that these Vs are actually becoming singular is a sign that the linearized approximation is not good. That's another way of seeing, I think, this basically the same phenomenon that you see here, which is that, you're creating a solution which has, curvature concentrated on some extremely singular surface, and your linearized approximation breaks down there. So one can consider this only sort of in a very formal perturbative sense, but that your perturbation theory is not good here. And in 2+1, I'm going to address that question of are you really allowed to think about these line operators? Yeah.
The curvature in this room is very small, so you expect linearized gravity to work very well until the Planck energy.
I agree.
So what's the purpose of this?
What's the purpose of this?
Yeah, this not singular transformation. It's not working in this room.
So the purpose of this construction is pedagogical. It's just to show that you can construct something that's like this singular electric field that we also never see in nature. and then to, as Dirac did, fix it up to make it something that you could imagine is in this room. So if I construct, you know, if I'm thinking about a particle in the middle of this room, I don't believe that it's attached to some singular line of gravitational flux. I believe it's probably surrounded by something that's described to an excellent approximation by a Newtonian potential. And that's the object that I'm about to construct. Okay, good. So, Coulomb field for gravity. Okay, and the way that we constructed this is actually pretty simple. You just take this singular line object, and since we're at the linearized level, you can just average it over a sphere. So that's what I'm going to do, and when you do that, so you average this quantity V over a sphere to get one I'll call VC for Coulomb. And it looks like this. So I'm going to assume that my particle is now sitting at the origin. So I'm just for simplicity of notation. Okay, and this is gamma mu RR times 1 over R. Okay, and you get this decaying factor from averaging, you know, averaging a line integral over angles, and you see that it decays like a Newtonian potential. Good. And as before, I define a phi Coulomb at 0, which is just phi 0 plus VC mu 0 d mu phi 0. Okay. And now I can ask what field this creates. And what Dirac suggests we do is look at the commutator. So I can look at this commutator, h mu nu of x, phi c at 0. Okay. Good. So that's going to have a bunch of terms. So the one that I'm interested in is the one that's coming from the dressing. So V lambda 0, V lambda phi 0. Okay. And now you notice from this that unlike the case of QED, in the QED case, you see directly that you take a commutator there of the electric field with this dressed operator, and you get back some specific electric field times that operator, which basically says that you're allowed to associate this particular electric field with that operator. Namely, if you act with this operator, it's basically just acting to translate the electric field up. Okay. Here the structure is a little bit more complicated because here you have a phi, but here you do not have a phi, you have a derivative. And what this is saying is that you can't precisely identify a single sort of classical dressing with this operator. Okay. But there's an approximate sense in which we can. So let's suppose that we're considering a particle at rest. So we're going to assume that it. Yeah, so we have some massive particle, which, you know, in this is sort of the large mass approximation of the field. Okay. And when we do that, it's the same object as before. We get something that looks as follows. So we get a kappa m by 16 pi r, t hat mu, t hat nu, r hat mu, r hat nu. So t hat's just the unit time vector, and r hat is the unit radial vector. Okay. And indeed, this is nothing but linearized Schwarzschild. Okay. Okay. But wait, there's more. it comes out in some funny gauge. So you have to look, as Laurent brought up, this quantity is not in itself a gauge invariant quantity. Okay, it doesn't. It's going to define for you some object that looks like a metric, h, you know, h mu, it has two indices and, you know, depends on a coordinate. It's going to be a metric in some, you know, in some gauge, which depends on the details of the, you know, the gauge fixing procedure that you use to define your commutators. And so you just have to look for it. So there's some diffeomorphism that takes you back. Nobody said that it had to be in Schwarzschild coordinates. So you get some diffeomorphism. Okay. And then 5, 0. Okay. So what this is saying is that this object you can think of, for at least for a particle at rest, it's creating some excitation together with its linearized gravitational field, and it's the familiar one, okay, linearized, of course. Okay. Good, and I should say there's a sort of further check that you can do, which is you can look at the ADM momenta with this phi c, and you find that what this gives is I d mu phi. So it's just lowercase phi here because I haven't, you know, because I haven't gone to higher order. So this is sort of plus kappa corrections. But what this is saying is that if I look at a field configuration with fixed momentum, so I say d mu phi, you know, I d mu phi is p mu phi, then the ADM expression, which is this integral in terms of the metric, actually, so first of all, it's generating translations and it's picking out the energy of these particles. So I've dressed my field in an appropriate way. It is, yeah. Pardon? Oh, yeah. It's an expression in terms of the asymptotic. You write it in terms of the asymptotic linearized metric. Yeah, that's right. And you assume your diffeomorphism fall off conditions are such that it's a well, you know, that this limit is well defined. Okay, great. Okay, so now one can look at commutators of these objects. Okay, and the interesting commutator I'm going to look at. Okay, so first of all, we can look at the Wilson line commutator. Let's say equal time. So I have phi Wilson dot, say x. And phi Wilson x prime. Okay, and that's going to have a bunch of terms that look like this. So v Wilson mu dot say at x with v nu Wilson at x prime times d mu phi x d nu phi at x prime. Okay. So there's a contribution to the commutator from the dressing, and and what you find is maybe unsurprising is that when these, so you have two things dressed by Wilson lines that run out to the boundary. If the lines line up, you get a very singular commutator. So this is order kappa squared, which is g because of these two guys. And so, for example, if you look at the translation along the along this z direction, or the component of the dressing along that direction, it has this very singular form. Also, just one power. So not only is it singular, does it have this delta function when the two things line up? it also has a contribution. Basically, this commutator contains contributions from these electric string or these gravitational string-like objects going all the way up to infinity. So there's also, in addition to this UV sort of divergence at coincidence, there's also this infrared divergence that depends on the distance to your boundary. Okay.
Reading in the beginning that you don't see such a singular object, but what about, you know, this gravitational memory effect? And if you like a particle, which is ion boosted, you know, these acceptance sacks type of solutions, then if you boost them very much, it looks sort of a bit like, you know, essentially the type of space time you're going to have has exactly these kind of delta 2 square along the transverse directions of the particle motion. So in the highly, you know, infinity boosted limits, because what you're doing is you're squeezing the thin lines, you know, the atomic field get completely, squeezed.
I see. Okay. So you're saying if you take a Coulomb field and then boost it very much.
In fact, the linearized solution has this kind of natural singular behavior because it's flat and it's flat the other way, and then there's just a shift in the transverse direction.
That's a very interesting question. So yeah, we haven't considered these sorts of highly boosted limits, but I think that's a very interesting. No, I like that. Unfortunately, I don't have an answer to your question. Yeah, it seems like good. One interesting aspect of this is indeed you sort of have to pick the dressing. There's a choice to be made, which at the very least has to pick out a Lorentz, is picking out a Lorentz frame. You know, you don't create a dressing that's spherically symmetric in all frames. You know, there's some frame that you pick out. And so, we've mostly been considering the case. So I'm going to consider here the case where you have two particles that are both at rest in the same frame. I agree. This is a really, that's a really good question. Thanks for bringing it up. Okay. Good. What you find is that there's effectively there's some effect that looks like a displacement of one particle relative to the relative to the other. So you can imagine, okay, I put in this, I act with one of my one of these gravitational Wilson lines. I create a highly excited state of the gravitational field, and then some moment later, I try to come in along this geodesic for a fixed distance and measure the field here. Well, as you can imagine, this highly singular gravitational field that you've created changes the notion of distance along here. And so you wind up at a point that's displaced in some large way from where you were. And it's sort of beyond the control of this linearized approximation. Okay. So there's a sort of translation effect of these commutators, which I'll come back to. Okay. And now what about the Coulomb commutator? Okay, so this one is nicer. So we want to consider, say, phi dot with phi at equal time again. Okay. And that again has many terms, but let's focus on the case where these two things are at rest. So there, the dominant contribution is going to be this one. So there's a VC0 dot at x, VC0 at x prime, phi dot at x, phi dot at x prime, and then I'm going to assume that these are both, you know, im times phi. And what you find from this is that this is precisely IG. So there's a G from the two kappas here. There's an M from each of these. And the integral of these Coulomb-like fields gives you another Coulomb-like field, 5x, 5x prime. So what this says is, I think, a sort of good message that, or takeaway message, is that the corrections to the commutativity of observables of sort of locality and field theory is really governed by the strength of gravitational effects between two objects. So you expect local, perhaps this is not surprising, but you expect local field theory to be a good approximation in flat space when the gravitational interaction between particles is weak. But this leads to a sort of, you know, a way to actually calculate and characterize these effects. Okay. So I think that's the main message of the first part of my talk, and I don't have a lot of time left, but I'd like to talk a bit about this the second part in three dimensions.
Okay. Now the right hand side is known in space time. But is there something we should expect in general for gravity, or it's is there an interpretation of this right hand side now? But is there like a more general?
I can give you a good. I can give you a sort of physical interpretation of this, which is you're acting with one of these dressed phis. So what you're creating is not just an excitation; you're creating an excitation plus its gravitational field. Okay. And now within that gravitational field, you have to come in and you have to identify a point. And the way you identify a point is the same way that you did in flat space by shooting in geodesics from all directions. Okay. So first you create this field, and now you're trying to identify this point here. And you send in some other geodesics. Okay? And these are not going to wind up all in the same place. They're going to be distorted in some way. Okay. In particular, they are not going to all lie on the same. So the dominant effect in this sort of Newtonian-like regime is that they don't all land at the same time. You know, so they're gonna miss your equal time slice by some amount, and the amount is being characterized by this commutator. But to some extent, it's open-ended. I mean, this effect is going to be there, you know, for example, in, you know, if you're trying to calculate gauge invariant cosmological observables, I think that would be, you know, interesting to look at. In the context of, you know, black hole physics, we frequently assume that the interior is sort of independent of the exterior, and this dressing effect shows that can't possibly be the case. So I think it'd be interesting to look at sort of different backgrounds and try to characterize these effects in those specific situations. But the takeaway message is that this is not an effect that you can get rid of. And so we need to think about it. Yes?
The standard picture of quantum gravity, this kind of linearized picture.
Yes.
The vertex between, say, two matter fields and a graviton.
Yes.
Is pointed by Dirac. It's a Dirac delta function.
Okay.
It's strictly local. You're saying this vertex is now no longer local. Is there a form factor to the vertex, or what's that?
I don't think that's what I'm saying. The vertex. I'm not used to thinking of these calculations in terms of Feynman diagrams because I'm sort of working in this canonical picture. But I think that the effect here is really. Is not that interaction. It's really what you're, when you're doing this dressing, you're looking at,
What happens to two phis directly?
I'm certainly not. Yeah, but I'm certainly not modifying the, I'm not modifying the Feynman rules of gravity or anything like that. So in terms of Feynman diagrams, I think what you can, the best way to think of it as is as a sort of dressing. So you want to think about how you'd want to think about your initial states, basically, for scattering. So so you might think of an initial, you know, you might try to consider a, you know, some process where you just send in some matter lines and, you know, have some gravitational interactions and whatever. Say some scattering process like this. Okay. And the lesson, I mean, the basic lesson is that these objects are not the right things to start with. They're not the right initial states of your theory. I mean, this is made very precise in QED by Fadeev and Kulish and others. Recently, people have thought about the same thing in gravity, how you have to consider dressed initial states, which are effectively, at the same time as you consider this, you also have to consider the soft gravitational field that comes along with the particle, which corresponds to a state that's not well described in terms of these diagrams. Unfortunately, it's essentially a coherent state of gravitons, which has, superpositions of all possible occupation numbers. So you have to consider initial states that, where sort of along with them come a whole, sea of soft gravitons, which then scatter back out again, in some different direction. And there's some soft factors that come along with these things. So it's, I haven't worked this out. This is just a rough picture, but if you want to relate it back to the sort of Feynman diagram scattering story, I think this is how it works.
But maybe what John's asking is there, or could you conceive that you can reformulate the theory instead of building Feynman diagrams with these undressed fields to reformulate it into these new theory of these dressed objects?
I think that's a great program, but yeah.
It has been 2 plus 1.
Okay.
And so do you find John's form factors, or is 2 plus 1 gravity? So.
You find a specific delocalization,
okay.
which has some, some interpretation. It's not, exactly this form factor. And the interpretation is a bit complicated, because as you say, 2 plus 1, the potential is even, kind of logarithmic. So, so the dressing, the asymptotic dressing is highly non-local. So, it's very hard to think of the S matrix you get in terms of particle picture. And so, you get the Feynman rules, but I don't think there is yet today, even in 2 plus 1, even if everything is explicit, it's non-perturbative. So, the Feynman rules are absolutely non-perturbative. But the proper physical interpretation of these dressed asymptotic states, I think it's still a challenge to understand it. So, but it might be a good time, with this new insight to revisit it.
Yeah.
But so this one, in some sense, yeah, you get some dressing form factor, the organization of the vertex.
I think it's, if you're in four dimensions,
mm-hmm.
and if you start with a non-local trace, you have to find from the end in the S matrix. It's not obvious why it doesn't have a non-local vertex.
I see. You're saying if you were to try and reformulate things in terms of these. Yeah, no, I think that, I mean, sure. You have a non-local commutator, so I don't see how you can avoid that.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, so it's not a quite particle.
No,
it's sort of as, in this perturbative approximation, it's sort of as close to a local point particle as you can expect to have, but in gravity, I think we have to give up that hope.
Like being pregnant and not pregnant.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, there's a Planck scale, right? I mean, in that sense, nothing is Okay. Well, all right. That's too philosophical for me. So with a little bit of time. Oh yeah, right. Yeah, okay. So I didn't leave myself a lot of time for this, so maybe I'll just try and summarize what we did. Okay. So good. Okay. So we're looking at ADS3 So gravity with a negative cosmological constant. I'm now going outside of that perturbative approximation, and I want to ask, how much can we focus? So we saw that we couldn't make these commutators zero everywhere, but we could sort of make them zero almost everywhere by focusing the gravitational field down to a line. And that works in the linearized approximation, but in the nonlinear theory, you expect this to break down. And can we have some idea of how that's happening? So we went to ADS3 because this is a context where you can solve, you know, gravitational problems exactly. Good. Okay. So what we want to do, so yeah, do these solutions exist? And also, what is the energy cost of focusing the gravitational field? All right. So I'm going to focus on, so I'm going to take a solution that's a conical defect in ADS. So we can view that. So it's some particle sitting at the middle, you know, of ADS in some equal time slice. And I want to, okay, and I want to ask, for a given mass, can I find a, you know, can I find a different dressing? Now, what's nice about ADS3 gravity is we know what all the solutions are. If I have a conical defect, the only this is the unique solution. A single conical defect of a given mass, this is the unique solution. Anything else must be a diffeomorphism of it. Okay, but the diffeomorphisms need not decay at infinity. So many of these are actually physical transformations, which you think of as adding boundary gravitons. Okay, so here I have some angle which I'll call phi, which goes around here, and I want to reparameterize it to some other angle, which I'll call var phi, in which the gravitational field is concentrated to some angle, which I'll call 2 alpha. So this angle here is alpha. Okay. Good. And the gravitational field is entirely characterized by what's called the boundary stress tensor, which is just a component of the gravitation, you know, of the asymptotic expansion of the gravitational field. And I want that to be equal to 0 in this region. Okay. And we know how this transforms. It follows, under a diffeomorphism, it follows the usual law of the stress tensor in a CFT. Okay. So C is the central charge, which is just written in terms of the ADS scale and the Planck scale. And there's this Schwarzian factor, which is well known from two-dimensional CFT. So that's just given by this sort of third derivative expression. Prime here means d by d straight phi. Okay, good. And now, right, so really I want to make some transformations such that t tilde tt equals it. So this has boundary stress tensor t tilde, and this has boundary stress tensor t, which is a constant. Okay, so now this is just some a differential equation problem that you can solve by giving it to a clever and motivated grad student, and that's Eric. Okay, and you solve. I mean, you can just directly solve it, but there's an intuitive picture of this. So you start with your defect, okay, which you start writing in these sort of round coordinates, but you can unwrap that into flat coordinates with the defect at the center. And now you're free to translate it by some amount. So now it's a Pac-Man that's sort of away from the center by some amount x. Okay, and then you can sort of cut out this region from, you know, this is angle alpha to minus alpha, and sort of stitch it back together over here. So you've mapped it to flat space here. You know that this whole thing is going to have zero stress tensor, and you can concentrate all the, as long as the defect angle, okay, so there's some angle here, delta phi, which is related to the mass. Right, so I'm in a convention where m is less than zero for the.
Because you will need ES now.
So yes.
Is the angle at the location of the
location of the particle, is it the asymptotic angle?
It's at the location of the particle. So this is the this is the location at the angle of the at the particle. Yeah.
But then,
yeah.
then it depends on far.
It depends.
The way it shows up on the Poincaré disk.
It depends on how you it depends on this translation.
Yeah.
So good. So part of the part of the point is that you can always confine the dressing to a small region if you're willing to put your particle way out on at the boundary. Mm-hmm. So as I phrased the problem so far here, I haven't said anything about where the particle is actually sitting. And that's actually kind of a, you know, it's kind of a tricky question. I mean, you're acting with some operator, you're changing the space-time, so how do you measure the distance? So I'm not going to get into the details, but basically you can look at the gravitational field. You can look at geodesics shot from the location of the defect itself, and if they hit the boundary, so if this thing's really in the center, they'll hit the boundary and they'll intersect it normally. If they're out here, they'll intersect it at some angle, and there's a sort of pattern of there's a sort of dipole gravitational field over here that you can use to identify sort of the translation of the particle. Okay. So it's possible to, so if you want to solve this with zero displacement, this is, it turns out that this is only possible if delta phi is less than 2 alpha. So that's precisely the criterion that you can take, that your alpha is sort of big enough that you can take this picture and then you can stitch this back together. Okay? But you can also characterize these solutions by the sort of minimal energy solution that you can do this as a function of displacement. Okay. So I'll just list some of the results that we found. So we have some displacement x, we have some energy E, we have some angle alpha that we want to squeeze everything into. So first of all, as you try to squeeze the gravitational field into the smallest possible angle determined by this limit, then unsurprisingly, the energy of the solutions blows up. So we can look for the minima, we can look for the solution. So supposing that we are allowed to translate our particle, we can look for the solutions that minimize the energy. So the displacement that this thing would for a fixed defect, you know, for a fixed defect mass and angle, there's some position of to put the defect that minimizes the energy. So there's some cost of squeezing the gravitational field lines, but there's also some gravitational potential energy that increases as you go out toward the boundary. And so what we find is that there's some positive, there's some displacement that minimizes the energy that's always positive. So what that's saying is that it's similar to this sort of translation effect that we found in these commutators, that these defects, really you're anchoring them to these gravitational field lines and they're getting pulled toward the boundary. So there's some optimal location that they'd like to sit at. And in fact, it goes like minus log alpha as alpha goes to infinity, as alpha goes to zero. So when you try to stretch these things as much as possible, they want to move out. The more you try to sort of confine the gravitational field lines, the more they want to get pulled out toward the boundary. Okay. And we found that that for light defects, so if we take, so in this convention, m equals minus 1 is ADS, so a light defect has mass minus 1 plus a little bit. What you find is that the energy is, okay, so this is the energy of a focused defect is the energy of the unfocused one plus a factor that's order epsilon squared. So the focusing is sort of quadratic in the mass of the defects, which explains why we didn't see it in this perturbative analysis. Okay, so I apologize for running over time. I just like to say, for I think that this picture sort of raises an interesting challenge for those in this room who are experts on non-perturbative quantization of gravity, is to find operator. So far we've looked at the limits on the solutions that you create that sort of dress your insertions, but I think it would be very interesting to construct operators that actually realize these and to study their commutators. All right, so I'll...
This is a classical,
isn't it? So, good. This is classical. All I'm looking at is it, you know, supposing that I have constructed some operator that with, you know, that's sort of compactly supported here and, you know, diff invariant, if I act with it on the vacuum, it can't create something that has a gravitational field everywhere. Its gravitational field must be focused. And so there are limits on how compactly supported my operators can be. But the question is, can you realize operators like that in the quantum field, in the actual quantum theory, say of a scalar field coupled
to
3D gravity?
He broadens these Wilson lines, that's what you're
saying. Exactly. It fattens them out, so you can't construct something that's like the Wilson line that I it simply doesn't exist in the non-perturbative theory. Now the question is, you know, can you make but there are things that you can construct that look more like this picture, where it's broadened out by some amount, and we've characterized exactly how broad it's going to be. And so the question is, can you actually construct such operators and study their properties within the quantum theory? Sort of dressed up. You know, it's sort of perhaps the simplest case that you could imagine of actually constructing these quantum dressed operators beyond the perturbative theory. Okay. So I'll stop there. Thank you very much for your attention. Yeah.
I just have a very quick question. The quantum commutator doesn't have MQED, or what does it look like?
It looks basically the same way. There's a Q. Good. It's the Coulomb. It's the Coulomb field.
What does it say about the difference between MQED and
MQED? Good. So it's saying that that if you consider good. It looks very similar, but in order to get that similarity, you had to do a bunch of approximate. So basically, the key assumption that I made here is that the particles are at rest. I think the lesson is that, you know, Newtonian gravity looks a lot like QED, and you know, as a first approximation to the gravitational effects, that's you know, the sort of leading thing that you might expect for particles that aren't, you know, say highly boosted relative to each other. But it also tells you, look, there's a lot more that you have to consider. So I suppressed a lot of, you know, I suppressed a lot of terms from this expression. So, right, this is just the dominant term. There's a VC, you know, in general, there are derivatives of both fields, and there are more complicated commutators VC mu with VC nu. And all of those things have to be considered.
The charge is a scalar. In gravity, the charge is a vector. So is entering there is going to be this vector p squared. So that's the main difference. So if you go to the limit where the vector is the scalar, then you get QED.
So my confusion is about this dressing. I mean, you're saying that this corresponds to some dressing, whereas in QED it does not. So it's kind of
QED, it's, it doesn't correspond to a dressing in QED? Sorry, I'm confused.
So it also corresponds to the same, similar kind of dressing in QED.
That's right. So yeah, you should, right, this operator here, this phi c, you can look at its commutators, say, with the gauge field. I didn't write it down. Pardon?
And the dressing there is isotropic.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's spin zero, but yeah, it's the electromagnetic field. Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
Wait, good. The Coulombic part. Fact,
yeah, yeah.
The thing is that, you know, it's not the spin one part that you're addressing.
Exactly.
This is the part that usually in perturbative regime you completely ignore.
Yes, precisely.
Right? Because it's the spin zero part of the electromagnetic field.
Yeah.
It's the Coulombic part.
Okay.
Gravity, the Coulombic part is in the lapse, right? So the lapse is.
That's right. That's right.
So.
Yeah, right.
This is why. I mean, there are all these. Yeah.
confusing statement about the like if you think of gravity as a theory of gravity and assume the particle,
yeah.
Then yes, the what's inside the horizon and outside the horizon don't touch to each other because yeah. gravity don't follow causal lines.
Mm-hmm.
But if you include the Coulombic part of the potential,
yes.
then you know they talk to each other.
Right. Yes. It's good.
This Coulombic part is the spin zero, which is usually in the particle picture it's expected.
So,
yeah.
So in QED, is this an effect that you cannot see at the perturbative level if you do just like estimate various 2-to-2 particle scattering, or?
Yes, that's right. Although it can sort of come back to bite you in various ways. Yes. It hard. Yes, exactly.
Usually you.
So the point being that in the infrared, when you take this sort of infrared limit, you're now in a regime where you can't distinguish. So the Coulomb field is like a zero frequency part of your thing. So as you take these sort of soft infrared limit as you send omega to zero, you start to get these sort of effects and it bites you. Yeah, this is this. Unfortunately, I didn't have much time to talk about this sort of Fadeev-Kulish story. You know, where you have infrared divergences and you have all kinds of techniques to kind of throw them away. But I think people are starting to realize, based on recent work on soft theorems and asymptotic symmetries, that really this is not something that you can, just sweep under the rug, as has been done for decades. That you need to actually think about these parts. So this is sort of a version that's not of this story, which is not in terms of scattering, but in terms of the sort of local field operators.
Yeah, because the usual story is like you say, well, okay, I have detectors and they put a cutoff and the things that fit in the detector, in fact, it's not going to be that particle, right? So you, but here, what you're trying to do is describe exactly what is going to be fitting in the detector, which is addressed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I should mention I'm here today and tomorrow as well. If you'd like to chat about this or anything, great. Thank you.